Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Every time you wanted to say addict, instead you had to say so-and-so is a person who suffers so much pain in their life that they didn't know how to relieve, so they turned to certain behaviors or substances to relieve the pain. That would change the conversation around addiction.
For an alcoholic addict such as myself, this is like meeting Father Christmas, except he's real. Gabor Marte is a doctor and expert in addiction, stress, and childhood development. But he's also, in my mind, something of a revolutionary, challenging all our assumptions about what it is to be well. His book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, was a great comfort to me when I had to get sober. And his new book, The Myth of Normal, looks at trauma, illness, and healing in a toxic culture. You will have heard guests on this podcast reference him. He's a recurring character, so it's great to have him here. Welcome to Mad World, Gabor Marte.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So the first question we ask all of our guests, from Prince Harry to Hunter Biden, how are you really?
Fundamentally, I'm well. I mean, I'm in this book tour after this project that took me 10 years of blood, sweat, and tears, to quote somebody. So it's a real pleasure and an honor to be traveling, talking about it. At the same time, as you can hear from my voice, it's rather cracked and croaking. And that's because I've really been talking too much. And yesterday I was feeling quite down, tired. Something happened and I reacted very much like a frustrated little child because I was depleted. Last night I slept well, so I'm feeling much better, but how am I? It fluctuates. But today, at the moment, feeling really well. Thank you.
Okay. So what I want to know about you is, you started out as what we would call in the UK a GP.
Yeah.
So you ran a general family practice in Canada. How did you go from, you put in a quote about, you know, the best physicians are also philosophers. And I feel like you've gone from being a physician to a philosopher. You are not just a GP, you are a healer, I would say. Mm. What led you down that path? How did you go from there to here?
Well, partly because, in fact, chiefly because, I don't know if you know Dante's Inferno, but it begins with this line saying, midway through life, I lost my path. And so midway in my life, I was quite a lost person. I was depressed and frustrated and irritable and marriage problems and difficulties with my kids. And I had to just, and like Dante, like, you know what he has to do? He has to go through hell to find redemption. I had to descend into the darkness of my own soul and my own traumas, you know, to figure out what the hell got me off the path. Now, that wasn't like an overnight effort, but it took a long time. But I really had to question what was making me behave and feel the way I was. And then furthermore, as a family physician, I couldn't help but notice that people got ill mentally or physically. They had traumas in their lives, and those traumas were related to their physical or mental health conditions. So reality kind of forced itself upon me. Now, nothing in medical school training prepares you for that. But if your eyes are open, you just see it, that who gets sick, who develops depression or anxiety. And as a family physician, you have an advantage in that you really get to know people before they get sick. Mm-hmm. Specialists only see people after they're diagnosed already. So the specialist doesn't know anything about the human being, and nor do they care to ask, because nothing in their training prepares them for it. Mm-hmm. They're just trained to deal with this particular body organ, not with the whole person in the context of their life. So it was a combination of my own struggles and the need to get to know myself with what I was observing as a physician that brought me to look at the larger issues of what happens to people, what forms them, what shapes their responses, what determines their worldview, what informs their self-concept, how that relates to their health and illness, and in what context all that occurs, which, properly speaking, is the entire world, the entire culture, which goes back to some very ancient teachings of the Buddha and indigenous cultures, that everything is connected. And that's not a new bit of wisdom. What is frustrating here is that modern science has more than validated that ancient wisdom, and modern medicine completely ignores that science. No, so that meant I was in a position, as somebody trained medically, to bring together all the science and all that wisdom and to talk about it. So that was the path.
You talk about the indigenous cultures, indigenous communities, and you reference in the book how indigenous communities that were colonized have some of the highest levels of not just mental illness, but also physical illness of addiction. And that sort of comes to the point, to the heart of this, which is that the way we are supposed to live as humans has been completely disrupted. And it's really not any wonder that so many of us are unwell. Connection with each other, connection with nature, it's all gone. And reading your work, time after time, I'm struck by this thought that just as we look back 150 years and go, I can't believe that surgeons didn't wash their hands and know that that was how infection spread.
Yeah.
Will we, well, we won't obviously, but in 150 years, will people look back at now and go, I cannot believe they went through life medicalizing so much mental illness, trying to medicate it, when actually what I really get from your work is that often these illnesses are the medicine in themselves. They're our body trying to say, this does not work for me.
Yes. So interesting you should mention hand washing, because there's a Hungarian physician called Ignaz Semmelweis, who in the 19th century in Vienna, they were delivering babies, and the women whose deliveries was conducted by medical doctors developed purpurea or fever, childbed fever, and died in large numbers. Mm-hmm. Those women who were looked after by my midwives, they were much safer from death. And this physician figured out that the difference was that the doctors would come from having just done autopsies on all kinds of infected, dead people. They wouldn't wash their hands. They go deliver babies. And he said, let's just wash their hands. He was hounded out of the profession.
Really?
He ended up very tragically dying in a mental health institution. And yet, this is before there was a microbe theory. He just observed what he observed. Mm. Now he's considered one of the great medical heroes. I think 150 years from now, we're going to look back and say, can't believe that these people separated the mind from the body. Mm. Can't believe how they didn't see the connections, the scientifically demonstrated connections between the person's psychology, physiology, and their social relationships. I mean, it's just so self-evident, you know. And what's strange about it is these are not new insights, not even in the medical world. Do you know what Socrates said 2,300 years ago? That the trouble with the doctors of today is they separate the mind from the body. Mm. 2,300 years ago. They don't see the whole. That's what he said. And there were great physicians here in Britain, in Canada, in France, who said that chronic illnesses like rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, had to do with emotions. Mm-hmm. And they had no science to prove it. They just had their intuitions. Today we have the science that demonstrates the connections and even the physiology of how those connections arise. Physicians are not trained to understand any of that. Mm. Oh, it's astonishing. It's really astonishing. The gap between science and medical practice is astounding.
But also that thing of emotions and physical illness, that can be quite a sort of, I suppose, in modern parlance, like a triggering thing for people. They can feel sort of blamed. But you're very clear in the book that this isn't about apportioning blame. It's not to say you're at fault for developing motor neuron disease or cancer, or it's saying that these are vital clues.
If you came to me with, say, an autoimmune illness like rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis, or scleroderma, or lupus, or any one of these things, what would you rather hear me say? You got this disease, who knows why, it's just bad luck, and we don't know what causes it, we certainly don't know how to cure it, and the best we can do is mitigate it if you take medications for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. Would you rather hear that? Or would you rather hear me say, these conditions have been shown by science to be very much connected to your emotional life, particularly to unconscious patterns that you developed through no fault of your own as a child, because as a response to trauma, as a response to certain emotional dynamics within your family, so you develop these adaptive responses, such as, say, suppressing your feelings. Mm-hmm. This wasn't your fault. This was adaptive. In fact, it was the brilliance of your organism. But unfortunately, those adaptations are no longer serving you. They're, in fact, getting in the way of your health. And so if we could talk about that, you could actually reverse or drop those compulsive patterns that you unconsciously developed, and there's something you can actually do about your own. I mean, which message would you rather hear? And there's no blame in that second one, because why would you blame somebody who developed unconscious adaptive patterns as a child in response to difficult circumstances? So there's no blame, but on the other hand, I'm giving you a sense of responsibility. I'm saying that you're responsible. You're able to respond once you become conscious of what's going on. So I think this is a much more humane and positive message.
Mm. We were talking just before we came in. I said that as an alcoholic, an addict, your work meant a lot to me. And you said, not just...
All I said was, no, you're not.
Yeah. And what did you mean by that?
Because nobody is their dysfunction. That's not who you are. And now you may have drank in a way that was harmful to you and your emotional life and even possibly your physiology and to your relationships. But that doesn't mean that's who you are. It just means that's something you did, and you did it for a reason. And my view on addiction is very simple, is that if you ask anybody, like, addiction is manifested in any behavior that a person finds temporary pleasure or relief in and therefore craves, but then suffers negative consequences as a result of and cannot give up despite that harm. Any behavior, I said, could be alcohol, could be sex, gambling, drugs.
Buying opera CDs.
Compulsive shopping for anything, you know, pornography, whatever. But then you ask anybody, not what's wrong with your addiction, but what's right about it. So if I ask you, for example, what did it give you temporarily, the drinking? What did it give you that you wanted?
Oblivion, freedom. Yeah,
and why would somebody need oblivion?
From pain.
Exactly.
Torturous pain. Compulsive thoughts.
Yeah. So, is pain relief a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a good thing.
Yeah. In other words, the addiction wasn't your problem, nor does it represent who you are. The addiction was your attempt to solve the problem of pain. Now, if I had to then delve into why you might have the pain, we would find that you were traumatized in your childhood. And so that the addiction is not any primary manifestation of who you are. It's just a pain response. It's totally normal to want to escape from pain when you know no other way. And so that's not who you are, who you actually are. If I could outlaw the word addict.
Really?
I would say, every time you wanted to say addict or alcoholic or anything, instead you had to say, so-and-so is a person who suffers so much pain in their life that they didn't know how to relieve, so they turned to certain behaviors or substances to relieve the pain. That would change the conversation around addiction. So I don't label people by their... And by the way, there's much more to you even than that pain response. There's also the liveliness and the creativity and the humor and the love. And, you know, so why would I identify you with one particular aspect of your behavior that was simply a pain response? Mm-hmm. So if somebody says, I'm an addict, no, you're not.
So it's interesting, though, isn't it? Because you go into this in the book that there are... When it comes to addiction, there are kind of two schools of thought. And the most kind of common and probably most unhelpful is that it's a moral failing.
Yeah.
And it's not. As you say, and as you can explain much better than me, addiction begins as an attempt to induce feelings that we were biologically programmed to generate innately and would have if unhealthy development hadn't got in the way.
Yes.
And as you said, the question to ask is not what is wrong with the addiction, but what is right, which you said.
Yeah.
I want to kind of go back to your work. Tell us about the work that you did with some of the most unwell, quote-unquote, addicts in Vancouver. You did. You worked for a very long time.
12 years, yeah.
People that the thought of getting them sober was almost cruel. And you talk about in the realm of Hungry Ghosts how you realized that we were essentially criminalizing and punishing people that were traumatized.
Yeah.
I think in our modern society, we have this notion of trauma, and you kind of go into it as well as capital T trauma.
Yeah.
And that's what I think a lot, especially in Britain, where we are like stiff upper lip, stoic, keep on.
Yeah.
Trauma is you've been in a war, something terrible has happened to you.
Yeah.
But as you point out, trauma can be not having your needs met as a child, which often isn't your parents' fault. I mean, you were separated from your mother in a concentration camp?
No, it was in Budapest, but under the Nazi occupation when I was 11 months old. Well, see, trauma is not what happens to you. We actually look at the word, the meaning of the word trauma, it means a wound. And so you can be wounded in a war, you can be wounded in a tsunami. I mean, psychologically wounded. You can be certainly wounded if you're abused sexually, physically, emotionally, etc. But you can also be wounded by not having your needs met. And human children, infants, are born with certain needs. When I say certain needs, needs that, if they're not met, that will distort their development. And you mentioned the indigenous cultures. Indigenous cultures, by and large, parented much more effectively, much more supportively, and much more lovingly than we do today. Kids were surrounded by a whole community of nurturing adults. It wasn't isolated parents living in a bungalow. It was the whole community. You know, the African saying, it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a tribe to raise a child. And kids were with the parents the whole day, the adults the whole day. So they were surrounded by nurturing, protective presences. It's very different from the modern world. Those same indigenous people who, by all documentation, knew how to parent much more intuitively and much more nourishingly than we do, now suffer the greatest incidences of child abuse, sexual abuse of children, neglect, violence in the family, addictions, suicides, and so on. This is true wherever you look, whether it's in Australia or Canada or the United States, all countries that your wonderful British Empire colonized and really visited disaster upon the indigenous people. These people are now in the Vancouver downtown east side that you mentioned where I work. 30% of my clients are indigenous. They make up 5% of the Canadian population. 50% of the women in jail in my country are indigenous. Mm-hmm. They make up 5% of the population. This is the result of the historical trauma that was visited upon them by colonialism and its aftermath. So in the downtown east side, and the downtown east side of Vancouver is in the Western world's most concentrated area of drug use.
Mm-hmm.
We have more people there within a few square block radius dependent on drugs than anywhere else in Britain or the States or any other country in the Western world. In my 12 years of work down there, as I've often said, I didn't have one single female patient who had not been sexually abused as a child. And all the men had been severely traumatized, many of them sexually and some in other ways, but trauma was the universal dynamic amongst them, and severe trauma, I mean. And the drugs was just an attempt to escape from the pain, just like the alcohol was in your case. And then these are the people that we ostracize, and we punish, and we criminalize, and we render homeless, and we feel superior to.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that were hurt by society are the ones also most punished by society. This is the humane Western world. It's, they can look back 100 years from now, or maybe 1,000, and they're going to say, what the heck did these people think they were doing?
Mm.
And, you know, I'm not saying anything revolutionary here. I mean, this is just what the science shows, what the research shows, what anybody who works with addictions, who have any, if they have any eyes that in their heads, they'll see. It's so self-evident, and yet it's contrary to the law, assumes that people, addicts by choice. I mean, if it's not a choice, what are we doing punishing them?
Mm.
I mean, does anybody ever wake up one morning and says, my ambition is to become a drug addict?
No.
You know, so it's something that people drift into because it's their attempt to escape from the pain. They don't even realize how much pain they're in.
They probably wouldn't even label it as pain.
They wouldn't because they're so used to it. But their organism experiences the pain. So when they find the drug or the behavior that soothes the pain, now they feel normal. So as one sex trade worker said to me, and I said, what does heroin do for you? She said, heroin is like a warm, soft hug, which is exactly what she didn't get as an infant and as a child.
Mm.
You know, so that's what addiction is. And so there's no choice in the matter. It's certainly not an inherited brain disease. That's a whole lot of scientific hogwash. I mean, I could expiate at great length about how nonsensical those theories of addiction as a brain disease is. Certainly it involves the brain. Everything involves the brain. But it didn't originate in the brain. The brain itself is shaped by the environment. And trauma has a significant impact on the child's brain development. And again, trauma doesn't have to be that severe, big T, big ticket disaster. It can also be a sensitive child whose needs are not met.
It's interesting because I was going to say that the other view of addiction, and it speaks to how little we understand it, is the very much the 12-step view, which is that it's a disease.
Yeah.
And I use 12-step programs, and they're very helpful for me. But you'd hear so often, sometimes people will talk about how there's all sorts of reasons, all sorts of things happened in my childhood, but that's not why I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And I find that a really interesting sort of theory. I know that I cannot pick up a drink and not then, you know, drinking, going crazy. But I'm also, as an alcoholic, when I was reading it, I was thinking, okay, so if I was, and I realize this is going into, and so I'm kind of calling myself out when I say it. So if I was to address the trauma from my childhood properly, would I then be able to drink properly again? Or would...
Well, first of all, you might not want to at all. Why would you want to?
That's such a good answer.
Secondly, the answer is yes. If you had really worked out the trauma and you weren't driven anymore to escape from yourself, you could have a drink. But I say, if any doubt, don't try to find out.
Yeah.
That's the practical answer. But as far as 12 steps are concerned, they're wonderful steps, not just for people addicted, but anybody. I mean, who wouldn't benefit from doing a moral inventory? Mm-hmm. Who wouldn't benefit from recognizing the limitations of the ego, the powerlessness of the little separate little self that we imagine ourselves to be? That who wouldn't benefit from seeking their higher power, however they wish to define it? So those are wonderful steps for life. But the 12-step movement is also largely in denial about trauma, which is really interesting because Dr. Bill W., one of the founders of AA, was a traumatized child. His parents abandoned him when he was 11 years old. And yet they don't talk about trauma. So there's kind of a trauma aversion there and a denial there. And so while I recommend the 12 steps, I also recommend don't just stop there. Ask why the pain. Mm. Not why the addiction, but why the pain and what happened to you. Combined, some trauma therapy combined with the 12 steps, really powerful. Mm. And so I'm not against the 12 steps. I just wish they'd have some trauma awareness to which in some 12-step meetings you might have access to, but it's rather disjointed and, you know, there's no organizationally, to the extent that there is an organization, they don't talk about trauma.
No. One of the really fascinating things in this book was talking about that we have to talk about all of this stuff more because either we want fewer people to be addicts or we don't, you know, or we want people to be addicts so, as you say, we can look down on them, you know, and it gives us a sense of moral superiority. What I'm so fascinated about is this idea. So we ask the question, why does my child have crushing self-loathing? Why does my child have mental illness? And you put forward this thing, which as someone who grew up with absolutely crushing self-loathing and obsessive compulsive disorder from a very young age, you make the point that all of that mental illness, you talk about it as an adaptation. Yeah. It's actually the best worst option.
That's
because
exactly
if
right.
a child doesn't adapt, they are left with the only other option, which is that your needs aren't being met, you're not safe.
Yeah, and I have to escape.
Yeah.
Which the child cannot do.
No. So, and that's a really revolution. I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
And yet it's so far away from what our culture sort of...
Well, we medicalize everything. We pathologize everything. And rather than understanding the sources of people's distress in their life experience, we create these pathologies. Take OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. So I don't know if anybody ever asked you this, but I would say it did something for you.
It made me feel safe.
Exactly. Was that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it was a good thing at the time.
Yeah, exactly. I would say it also did other things for you. Gave you a sense of control.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever you did, wash your hand 99 times or check the door 105 times, it gave you a sense of control.
Yeah.
When you were growing up, you had no sense of control, no sense of safety. It also made your mind engaged with something that was in itself not painful, kept your mind off the pain.
Yeah.
So the OCD served you. No, it also harmed you. These adaptations, they come along. They're not meant to be forever. They're meant, an adaptation is meant to work as long as the conditions demand it. But the nature of these childhood adaptations, such as tuning out because things are too stressful, and then you're diagnosed with ADD 40 years later or 50 years later as I was. Well, the adaptation of tuning out when there's too much stress is meant to last as long as you're helpless in the face of stress. Mm-hmm. But since these adaptations happen early and they're ingrained in the brain during the period of sensitive brain development, you can't just drop them. You're not even aware of them as adaptations. I mean, if it was really cold in London, which it does get cold here, you'd adapt by how?
You'd put on some warm clothing.
Exactly. Now, what would happen to you if in the summertime you're still wearing that warm clothing?
You'd get a heat stroke.
Yeah, you'd suffer. The same adaptation that saved your life in one context will kill you in another.
Mm.
Nothing wrong with the adaptation in the first place. The difference is with the example of putting on the warm clothing, you did it consciously. Therefore, you can undo it consciously. These childhood adaptations are unconscious. The organism takes them on, not because of the child's deliberate will, but because there's a unconscious survival mechanism. And once you identify something with survival, you're not going to give up that easily, even if the conditions change. And in a different environment, those same adaptations will hurt you, which is where therapy comes in. But the origins, there's nothing wrong with you to start with. These were normal responses to abnormal situations.
Mm.
It was not normal in the sense of healthy or natural for you to go through whatever traumas you had to go through as a child. That's not what nature prepared you for. Nature prepared you to be loved, accepted, unconditionally celebrated, seen, heard for who you were, and to be allowed to experience all your emotions and to play freely and to feel very safe. That's what nature prepared you for. So that anything else is abnormal. And then your adaptations were normal responses to abnormal circumstances.
You mentioned kind of consciousness and how much of life is below the tip of the iceberg. You know,
yeah.
There's so much hidden below. The other thing I find so interesting, I'm specifically interested in the addiction nature of this, but it's fascinating for all of us because we see addiction in a very binary way, you know, a very black and white way. It's a drug addict or it's someone on a park bench. But you point out that addiction, in a way, is at the very heart of our culture. So capitalism, consumerism, you know, the forces within them prey on our addictive compulsions. So I haven't got my phone with me, but it is, you know, they are designed specifically to make you want more. Social media designed to make you want more.
Yeah.
You point out they have neuromarketers.
Get that phrase, neuromarketing.
Yeah.
It's actually deliberately concocted to hijack your nervous system in a way to reach it to its highest addictive craving, which will make you consume even more.
Mm.
Never satisfy, because if you're satisfied, you could stop doing it.
Yeah.
But to excite your brain circuits to the point where you keep wanting the same thing. And the consumer society is based on that. I mean, we don't need most of the junk that we buy.
No.
And we certainly don't need them in the elaborate way that they're presented and so on. So, you know, there's a book written long before my book called When Society's an Addict. It was all about this.
But also, I think we're sort of addicted to stress, aren't we? And I was just thinking, just at lunchtime, I went out to get a sandwich from this, like, chain of sandwich shops called Prep. And I was in there, and the queue was out the door, and there were people sort of screaming, going, oh, cappuccino, tuna toasty. And it was so stressful. And I was looking at people who were just like, and I thought, this is how we live our lives. Like, we wake up in the morning, an alarm clock goes off, immediately stress hormones into our brains. And then that carries on throughout the day. So no wonder we are all desperate for this sort of balm for our soul. We overeat.
And not only that, I don't know what it's like for you, but when you first wake up in the morning, what's the first thing you do?
I literally get up, go downstairs, and I have a black coffee with a cigarette.
Uh-huh, okay.
Then I check my phone.
Then you check your phone, yes. One, no, what the black coffee and the cigarettes do is they elevate the level in the brain of a substance called dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
And dopamine is essential for life.
Yeah.
It's essential for a sense of vitality, for curiosity, for seeking. Dopamine flows when you're exploring a novel environment, seeking food, seeking a sexual partner. So it's the vitality, excitement, being alive, being engaged, chemical in the brain. Mm-hmm. And nicotine and caffeine, like crystal meth or cocaine, these are all stimulants. They elevate dopamine levels. And then you go to another behavior that also excites your dopamine circuits called the cell phone. Mm-hmm. So basically, you start the morning with behavior that's designed to elevate in your brain a substance that should naturally be there in sufficient quantity that you wouldn't need those things. Mm. I'm not against coffee. I'm just saying that there's a reason why it works.
So tell me about babies and dopamine receptors. Yeah. And the healthy development,
yeah,
in very, very tiny infants,
yeah,
of their dopamine receptors, and how it's been found that some addicts have slightly skewed dopamine receptors.
Well, so here's the thing, that it's another one of these deeply hidden medical secrets, because they've only been published in 10,000 journal articles, that the human brain develops an interaction with the environment. So it's the environment acting on the genes that shapes the physiology of the brain. And to quote a Harvard article, an article from Harvard Center on the Developing Child, published 10 years ago in the Journal of Pediatrics, which is the official journal of the American Pediatric Academy, the human brain develops through a complex process that begins before birth and continues into adulthood. So that means the child's brain is already being shaped in utero. We know that stress on the mother during pregnancy diminishes the child's dopamine receptors. That means that the mother's emotional states during pregnancy can already program the child towards addictive tendencies, where they have to meet their dopamine needs externally, mm-hmm, and also towards things like ADHD, which is really a question of dopamine. In fact, when we give medications for ADHD, we give stimulants like Ritalin or Vivenza or Dexedrine or Adderall. These elevate dopamine levels. Here's the thing about the brain. It's a biological organ, but the biology is interactive with the environment throughout the lifetime. So you take monkeys and you put them into isolation, that'll diminish the number of dopamine receptors. And that means there'll be less dopamine activity in there. They'll be more listless. You put them back into company, their dopamine receptors come back, unless they're bullied, in which case they don't. So that our interactions with the environment actually program our brain. And that begins in utero. And then the second paragraph of that same, or the second sentence of that same Harvard summary of brain development says that, basically points out that the most important influence on the development of the brain is the emotional interaction with the nurturing caregivers. So what shapes the physiology of the brain is actually our emotional relationships with our parents and other nurturing caregivers. When those relationships are troubled, because the parents are stressed, because the parents are traumatized, because the parents are under economic pressure, mm-hmm, because the parents suffer racism, because the parents haven't worked out their childhood traumas yet, which was the case with my wife and I when we were parents, that's going to affect the brain development of the child. Mm-hmm. Cannot help but, because that's how the brain develops. So when we look at this idea of brain diseases, what we're actually looking at is the impact of the environment. So, yeah, dopamine or the opiate circuitry, the endorphins, that the opiate drugs like heroin, they work in our brain only because we have receptors for opiates. Mm-hmm. Receptors being molecules on the cell surface that receive the messenger molecule from the environment. Opiates are these messenger molecules. Why do we have receptors? You know, opiates derived from opium grown in Afghanistan. Why do we have receptors for opium grown in Afghanistan? We don't. We have receptors for our own internal opiates, which are called endorphins, endogenous morphine-like substances, and they have significant roles in human life. Endorphins, we couldn't live without them. Mm-hmm. They provide pain relief. Imagine life without that. They provide a sense of pleasure and reward and elation. Try and live without that. And they also make love possible, connection. And so children whose conditions are troubled when they're growing up, for whatever reason, they don't develop these systems adequately, nor they're sitting ducks for addictions. And by the way, any addict, whether they're addicted to gambling or shopping or sex or drugs, they're looking for a big dopamine hit. So when I had my shopping addiction, it wasn't this compact disc that I was spending thousands of dollars a day on. It wasn't the love of music. I loved the music. I still love the music. But that's not what I was addicted to. I was addicted to the shopping, because the shopping temporarily would give me a dopamine hit. Mm-hmm. The gambler is not after the money. Because if they're after the money, once they win, if they win, they stop going. But they're back the next day losing the money. Because what they're actually after is the thrill of the dopamine rush that they get. In other words, all addicts, the only difference between a cocaine addict and a gambling addict or a shopping addict is that the gambling addict and the shopping addict or the workaholic, they get their dopamine through that activity. Whereas the cocaine addict has to rely on the injected substance. Mm. Then we look down on these people as somewhat different than the rest of us.
You make the point that, you know, you mentioned workaholism, and I think that's crucial in the culture we live in. And in a way that we would not applaud someone for having alcoholism or drug addiction. We look at the people at the very top of who run our systems. You point out sort of presidential candidates.
Yeah. And I could also have put in some prime ministerial candidates. In fact, I did, but there wasn't enough room to keep them in, so I...
Oh, but you talk about Tony Blair.
I mentioned Tony Blair, but I didn't, not in that sense.
Well, you can talk about it now if you want.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at a figure like Margaret Thatcher, she was notoriously a closed book to herself. There's no self-reflection, no self-awareness there at all. And she desperately needed power. And why? Why does anybody... Why do any politician cling to power so desperately? A recent example in Britain, I mean, it was Boris Johnson who one week, I'm called upon to lead the nation. And by next week, his own party says, well, buddy, you better go because we can't stand you anymore because you're losing votes for us. You know, we never cared you about a person. We cared about you because you could provide us with
votes.
Validation. And now that you can't, you're a losing proposition. Get the heck out of here. Mm. That's the ethics of politics. But why do they need to cling to power so much? Because they don't know who they are without it. Mm. Why don't they know who they are without it? Because they didn't get the validation and valuation as children. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these politicians are very troubled, traumatized people. And we see them. I mean, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or any number of Canadian or British prime ministers, really troubled people. But we make them successes, just like I was a success. My workaholism made me very successful. This doctor who's always available and always so kind and never says no to new patients, and you can call him day or night. And that same wonderful guy was not available for his family. And when he wasn't working, you mentioned being addicted to adrenaline. I was an adrenaline junkie. I was addicted to my own stress hormones. So when I wasn't under stress, I felt irritable, like any addict in the withdrawal, and I was depressed. So on the one hand, society rewards some of the most egregious addictions with adulation and power. On the other hand, on certain addicts, we look down upon as beneath us.
It's so interesting that what you say about when you got to your midlife, that was when you start to question.
Yeah.
I'm 42, and I definitely feel my whole... success. What I've realized interviewing people is that often the most successful people are the most unhappy.
Yeah.
They are driven by deep unhappiness from their childhoods. Yeah. That's a kind of generalization, but it really does go across the board.
Of course.
And I remember when I used to read about, say, an actress or an author who became a recluse, right? And they've died, and then they talk about how they were incredibly successful, and then they became a recluse. And I would always think, oh, that poor, they're obviously a bit wrong in the head. I now realize that people that junk it all and go, this is not for me, I want to go and live in the forest with, they're actually the sanest of all of us.
Well, you know, there was, of all the rulers that I know, there was one that I remember, Charles V was led the Holy Roman Empire, and he actually retired, and I think went to a monastery. But you never see that too much. Mm. People cling to power. And that's part of the toxicity of our culture that I describe in this book, The Myth of Normal, is that society rewards some very toxic behaviors and even adulates and admires these people who engage in them. I mean, that's backward. Mm. You know, I mean, if in your personal life you met somebody who wanted to dominate everything and was always saying things that turned out not to be true, would you be friends with them?
No.
But these are the people we keep electing. And we even expect it. Mm. We're surprised when it isn't like that. You know?
Yeah.
That's there's something askew here.
Let's talk about toxic culture, because that whole thing of the disconnection we have, you talk about. I mean, I cannot help but think of lockdown as we've just had it. But you say a society that fails to value communality, our need to belong, to care for one another and to feel caring energy flowing towards us, is a society facing away from the essence of what it means to be human. Yeah. I'm just reading, but you're like, I know, Bryony, I wrote this.
Those are really good words, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Pathology cannot but ensue. To say so is not a moral assertion, but an objective assessment. And then, you mentioned racism, and black people suffer more diabetes, obesity, hypertension and strokes, not to speak of mental illness. And that amazing quote from James Baldwin way back in 1961, which is to be black in the US and to be relatively conscious is to be in a rage almost all of the time.
Yeah.
So no wonder. But you also talk about women. Women suffer more chronic illness of the body than men.
Yeah.
And this is all about subjugation, isn't it? And and power structures that we live in.
Yeah. So the book was published a month ago today, September the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
A week later, there was a study in the States that show that even a single instance of racism will disturb the immune system and the hormonal apparatus. Now imagine over a chronic period of time what that'll do to your immune system. So no wonder black people, particularly black women, suffer more autoimmune disease when the immune system turns against them.
Mm-hmm.
Now women in general suffer, 70-80% of autoimmune diseases happen to women. Mm-hmm. And this is a big medical mystery. Why? Well, as far as I'm concerned, there's no mystery whatsoever. Because autoimmune disease happens to people who stifle their emotions, who automatically and compulsively serve the needs of others, who repress their healthy anger so they don't set boundaries that'll protect them, who feel that they're responsible for what other people feel, and they must never disappoint anybody. Now, which gender in this culture is acculturated to fulfill those criteria? It's women. And that's why they have so much autoimmune disease. And again, race plays a function here, because when you're black in the States, you can have a lot of anger, but it's dangerous to express it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to repress it. No wonder they have more disease. We have this mysterious condition called hypertension and high blood pressure. Doctors say, well, it's idiopathic, which means we don't know what causes it. We don't know what causes it? Just parse the word hypertension. Hypertension, too much tension. And so no wonder black American kids start showing hypertension even in childhood. It has nothing to do with their genetics, because their African relatives do not.
Mm.
It has to do with repression in a racist society. So all these social factors, and in case of women, the culturally engendered role that they're trained basically to accept. There was a study in the States during COVID times. And the article said society is shock absorbers.
Mm-hmm.
And the study showed that women felt responsible for their spouse's stresses and their family's stresses. And they felt guilty when they couldn't protect their spouses and families from the stress of the COVID circumstances. Mm-hmm. They felt guilty. So society is shock absorbers. So I borrowed that article title for the chapter in this book. There was a study in Canada that looked at recovery after open heart surgery, and women notoriously do worse than men. And this study showed that when a man has open heart surgery, they go home, they get taken care of. When a woman has open heart surgery, they go home and they resume their caretaking role. It's that, no, it's not conscious, it's not the woman's fault. It's simply how people are trained and acculturated and how they develop. But the result is significant impact on the physiology, because scientifically you can separate the mind from the body. So when you're messing with the emotions and suppressing them, you're playing havoc with your physiology.
Everything about our culture, from the political systems we live in, to the media we consume, to the food we eat, are toxic to us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was thinking about that. You talk about how the climate crisis is intricately connected to our mental health.
Yeah.
The madness of it is that we're not just killing our planet, but we are killing ourselves. And I think right now, you know, in the UK, we have this thing of, are we going to turn on our central heating?
Yeah.
You know, gas prices, a cost of living crisis.
Yeah.
We're going to have blackouts this winter, we've been told.
That's what I heard. As a result of which, people will die.
They will. But to me as well, this is, you know, if we talk about that higher power thing and having a sense of communion and connection to the universe, like there is a message here.
Yeah.
And that message is that we cannot go on living like this. This is not sustainable.
Well, that's just interesting. Because if, let's say you had a garden and somebody was coming in there and messing it and polluting it and destroying the plants and killing the beneficial fauna and flora and insects. This is your garden. And somebody was coming in and doing that to you. What would you do?
You'd get rid of them.
Yeah. But we accept the same dynamic massively on the social scale and we're completely passive in the face of it.
Mm.
So that socially we live much more passively and we resign ourselves to circumstances that we'd never accept, most of us, in our personal lives.
Mm.
And that's part of the toxicity of this culture, is that it makes people so passive. Now, Britain participated in two American-instigated wars, one of them being the invasion of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you to Tony Blair, where 500,000 people were killed, Iraqis, not to mention thousands of British men and British people and Americans and so on. Now, I'm pretty sure that if I found the average Briton, say British male, and I said, tell me about how you feel about the latest acquisition by Manchester City of this Norwegian striker who's, every time he plays, he scores a hat trick. Haglund, his name is. They would talk volubly about Pep Guardiola and his management of Manchester City and what combination of players would have them be the most effective against which opposition. If I asked that same British male, now put together two sentences for me, logical, historically accurate sentences about the history of Iraq or the history of Afghanistan, they couldn't rub two words together that made any sense. Now, which is actually more important?
Mm.
Which is a greater consequence in their lives? I'm not blaming the average British male. I'm saying that's what the culture does. It diverts us with stuff that's totally irrelevant. I mean, it's interesting and enjoyable. I love football. You know, I grew up in fact, my country beat you guys in 1953, I think it was, at Wembley Stadium, 6-3. It was one of the great moments of my life, you know.
hanging on to that one.
No, I'm still holding on to it. No Hungarian who lived through that ever forgets that victory, 6-3. And then when Britain came to Canada, to Budapest, you know how much we beat you guys by? 7-1. Now, that was a long time ago. So I'm not against football. But what I'm asking is what actually is important in your life? What wars your country is engaged in and its consequences? Or which football player does your favorite team acquire or not? I mean, there's no comparison. That itself is the sign of the toxicity of the culture that makes us value and engage with things that have no significance to our lives. And ignore the larger questions that do have great significance and great consequence, or which we know nothing at all. I mean, that itself is a sign of a toxic culture.
How do we challenge it? I mean, there's quite another James Baldwin quote, which is, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced.
Well, that sums it up.
This is the start or the ongoing work.
Yeah. So people need to... Look, my intent in writing this book was... basically to help wake people up, those that are interested in being woken up, by the way. Not everybody is. And furthermore, to help people get to know themselves, not as isolated individuals, but as part of a culture which shapes how they are and how they view the world, but which they don't need to be passive, acted upon subjects, but they can actually take an active role, a sense of agency, coming from our own authentic selves. And how do we connect with that? I mean, that's the essence of the intent of this book.
Mm.
I don't have simple answers, but at least we have to start talking about it.
So if there is anyone listening right now who what you say resonates, which absolutely does for me, you talk about things like the 5 A's and trauma consciousness. I know it's to say to you, could you just sum up in 5 minutes your best advice for people listening about how to heal? To heal, how to start, to even begin that journey.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the 4 A's. There should be a fifth one. Were I to write the book again, there'd be a fifth one there. The four that are there are anger, healthy anger, because again, a repression of healthy anger makes you a sitting duck for illness. Because of the scientifically documented unity of our emotional apparatus with our immune system, when we repress our emotions, we're actually disabling our immune system itself. Yeah. And just as anger that you suppress, that you repress, turns against you in the form of self-loathing, so can the immune system turn against you. In fact, anger and the immune system have the same role, by the way. Because what's the role of healthy anger? It's to protect your boundaries. Mm. If I were to intrude upon you now, you'd say, stop, get out. That's healthy anger. Nothing wrong with it. In fact, it's necessary. Now, once it served its function and protected you, you wouldn't have to keep getting angry or staying angry. You just say, okay, well, it's over. Healthy anger then is a boundary defense. What is the immune system? It's also a boundary defense. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's called a floating brain. It has memory, learning capacity, and reactive capacity, just like the brain. In fact, it is part of the brain because the immune system is inseparable from emotional apparatus or from our hormonal system. It's all one. So given that it's all one, if you repress anger, we're also messing with our immune system. So that's the first point, is healthy anger, which no one-day-old baby is without. You just try and feed them something they don't want to eat. You find out what healthy anger is all about. So that the loss of that is a result of trauma. So that's the first thing, anger. Second thing is acceptance. And acceptance doesn't mean toleration, putting up with bad stuff. It just means actually accepting that, oh, this is how things are right now. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to deny how it is. I'm not going to turn a blind eye to how it is. Nor am I going to just sit there resenting how it is. This is how it is. What can I do about it? Yeah. So that's acceptance. Agency, which is actually being an active agent in your own life, like rather than just being the passive recipient of healthcare or other people's decisions, you're actually the agent in your own life. Mastery, that's an essential human need. And so where did we lose it? Where did it become passive and how do you regain it? That's the issue of agency. Authenticity is the fourth one. And authenticity, again, it's not some fancy concept. It's very practical. If I ask any group of people, as I did this morning, I talked to 500 policemen and women here in London about trauma and addiction. And I asked my usual question, or the other day at the How To Academy, I asked 1,000 people, raise your hand if you ever had the experience of having a strong gut feeling about something and you ignored it and you're sorry afterwards. Now, would you raise your hand for that?
Yes.
Yes, of course. Which tells me about your childhood. Because no one-day-old baby ignores their gut feelings. So something happens. And what happens is that we learn that to be in touch with our gut feelings is to put us in conflict with our environment. Therefore, the sake of belonging and acceptance, we give up on our authentic selves. It's that simple. Now when we evolved out there in nature, how long does any creature in nature survive if they don't know their gut feelings?
Not very long at
all. Not very long. So we're not talking about some abstract new age concept here. We're talking about an essential human need to be authentic, auto the self, to be in contact, in connection with our emotions and our bodies. That's authenticity. And to be able to act from them as necessary. In this society, most of us, I mean, out of 1,000 people, when I ask that question, 980 at least will put their hands up, which means they're telling me about what happened in their childhoods because we were born authentic. Mm. We can regain that authenticity. So that's the fourth A of healing. The fifth one that I would include if I were to rewrite that chapter would be awareness. Because to make all the others work, you have to be aware of what's going on. Mm. I kind of took that for granted, but it should have been in there.
I think there are five in here.
No, there's only four.
Oh, okay.
Trust me.
I've written down five A's.
Well, there you go. you fantasized one of them.
Do you know what? We could do a whole separate podcast on attachment versus authenticity.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to say personally that chapter particularly really helped me at the moment, just some stuff that is going on in my life. That ability to be able to kind of step back and see, you know, there's something so liberating about seeing that I am not a freak or that actually it's my brain wiring.
Yeah, that's right. And your brain wiring for a good reason.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something incredibly liberating. And that, for me, is one of the most helpful. The whole attachment theory thing has been one of the most helpful things in my day-to-day life and recovery. I was wondering if you could just read the... I obviously don't want to spoil this book.
Yeah, I don't know. It's long enough that you can't spoil it.
If you could just read the last couple of paragraphs of the book, because I think they landed so much in my heart, and I would just love personally to hear you read them.
By the way, at this point, for two reasons, I have to give a shout out to my son, Daniel, with whom I wrote this book and without whom I could not have written this book. And he's the one who actually reads the audio version. And the audio version is the second best-selling audiobook in the United States right now.
It's 18 hours.
Yeah, it's 18 hours, yeah.
That's a lot of reading.
Myself, I don't listen to audiobooks. I want to have a book in my hand. But the audio version is selling incredibly well, and Daniel's the one who does the reading. So this is me standing in for my son, Daniel. The other reason I want to give a shout-out to him is because these last paragraphs were largely written by him in connection with me, like we wrote together, but much of it was... came through him. Anyway, these are the final paragraphs of the book. It all starts with waking up. Waking up to what is real and authentic in and around us and what isn't. Waking up to who we are and who we're not. Waking up to our bodies are expressing and what our minds are suppressing. Waking up to our wounds and our gifts. Waking up to what we have believed and what we actually value. Waking up to what we will no longer tolerate and what we can now accept, waking up to the myths that bind us and the interconnections that define us, waking up to the past as it has been, the present as it is, and as a future as it may yet be, waking up most especially to the gap between our essence calls for and what, quote, normal has demanded of us. We are blessed with the momentous opportunity, shedding toxic myths of disconnection from ourselves, from one another, and from the planet. We can bring what is normal and what is natural bit by bit closer together. It is a task for the ages, one that can redeem the past, inspire the present, and point to a brighter, healthier future. It is our most daunting challenge and greatest possibility.
Carol Marte, thank you so much. It's been one of the greatest privileges of my working life, my life generally, to meet you and get to hear you speak for an hour. Thank you so much for coming on this podcast.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Before you go, please follow Mad World on your podcast app to make sure you never miss an episode. And if you feel like it, leave us a rating and a review. I love to read what you think about the shows and also see your guest suggestions. Mad World is all about helping our listeners, and I love hearing from you. The Telegraph also let me loose in column form, so if you'd like to hear even more from me, head to telegraph.co.uk/madworld and you can get your first 30 days access to the website completely free. If you've been affected by anything we've talked about in our podcast today, the following organisations offer free and confidential support over the phone. The Samaritans can be reached 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on 116 123. Or you can contact the mental health charity Mind for advice on a range of mental health issues. Their phone number is 0300 123 3393. That's 0300 123 3393. They're accessible 9 a.m. to 5 p.m, Monday to Friday, excluding bank holidays. There's also Young Minds, who provide support if you're a parent or a carer worried about a child's welfare. They're on 0808 802 5544. That's 0808 802 5544. If you prefer tech support, Shout is a 24/7 UK crisis tech service available for times when people feel they need immediate support. By texting Shout to 85258, you will be put in touch with a trained crisis volunteer who will chat to you via text. And importantly, please remember this. You are not alone.